Hello everyone, we are here at VCU in one of the production rooms at Blackbird with our senior editors, graduate and undergraduate staff, and Lina Maria Ferrer Cabeza Venegas to discuss her 100 Reputations, which was serially published last spring with the Brooklyn Rail. As you know, I'm Catherine Mooney Brooks, the lead associate editor of Blackbird, and I'm so grateful that Lina is able to join us today to discuss this project. Lina Maria Ferrer Cabeza Venegas teaches nonfiction here at VCU. She's a graduate of the University of Iowa's Creative Nonfiction and Literary Translation programs and is the author of Drown, Sever, Sing, and Don't Come Back. She was featured in a reading with Mark Doty, published in the fall issue of Blackbird, V17 and 2. So welcome, Lina, and thank you so much for taking the time to talk about 100 Reputations. Maybe you can talk a little bit about its history and give some context.
Sure. Thank you for the introduction, Catherine Winnie Brooks. So what's interesting is you have that thing up there, and maybe you've already seen it, and I'm going to tell you that same story, but in my own words. So ignore what's up there and just listen to me. 100 Reputations is possibly the worst thing I've ever done to myself. There was no glory, there was no money, there was nothing in it. There was just pure, unadulterated rage, and that's surprising amount of work can come from it. So I was sitting in my grandmother's apartment. My grandmother died a few months ago. So it's an empty apartment, and it was just full of symbols, and nations and countries are fought for grandmothers. When you ask somebody, like, why do you go to war? Like, what is your country? Realistically, very few people are going to go for the Grand Canyon. This is why we go to war and, like, fight and have flags. Like, very few people. Like, these are all symbols. But realistically, your country is your family and your flesh, and this is as far as it goes. So I was in my grandmother's apartment. I'm Colombian, born and raised. This is not my first language. This is not my country. And my mother always keeps the radio on in the background. And I'm sitting right before this really ancient Virgin that my grandmother got in Ecuador, one of the oldest places where you can find in Latin America, like these relics. And she's balancing on this upturned moon on the edge of it, as if like it were an upturned scythe. And she's digging her heel into the back of the snake's skull, and the snake is just frozen in place in this perpetual scream. And I'm just sitting right underneath it when I hear these words come out of from the radio, and they say, again, this words that will get debated on NPR Voices, on the radio, forever and ever, and all these articles, was it shithouse or was it shithole, but it doesn't fucking matter, because the way they're translated is shit countries, that's it, países de mierda. And I hear these words, and it just, I have trouble explaining how devastating it feels, because symbols aren't symbols, they're real. Everything is real, all the time. And I know what it's like growing up with no expectations. I know what it's like to be abroad and for people to tell you that there are no expectations of you, that there are only negative expectations of you. I still have people approach me at parties and ask me for cocaine. Still, after these things, after readings, people will still approach me and think, you know what? I'm going to ask her what she thinks about Narcos because that was a dope show. And they'll say, dope show, with absolutely no irony. And I can't explain how I don't watch a show that I lived through, that I have no interest in it, that other people have different relationships to it, that there are people who had worse relationships to it, and maybe that's fine, but that's not me, and I can't take it. So I hear shit countries, and I keep thinking about all these walls and all these metaphors and how they're already there. It doesn't matter. And we're all going to pay for them forever and ever. That's it. And they exist, and I'm sitting in my grandmother's apartment right underneath this Virgin, and I don't know what to do. And I do what I always do when I don't know what to do, which is I yell. I yell a lot. It's what I do. And my mother, who is always afraid for me, particularly because I do yell and I'm loud and I say these things and I am not a citizen and I have no protections and I can't go anywhere near rallies because I don't get arrested, I get deported. She's very scared for me. She's reasonably scared for me. And all she's telling me all the time is just calm down, don't get near it, don't go near it, don't touch it. And I'm still in a very incredibly privileged class of immigrants. She's still afraid, and it's still reasonable because it is so very, very unreasonable. So I'm yelling, and she keeps trying to calm me down, and she calls me a little short fuse because I am that. And she keeps asking what I'm going to do. Like, how can this possibly help? How can me being angry about something me being really realistically very sad about something, because my grandmother is my country and she was my first literature. When you say shit countries, what you're saying is that that is also who she was and who she is and who I am by extension. And that matters less to me than the people who are my country, who are my family, who are my kin, who are in cages. So I have to like wonder what I can possibly do. And I have to wonder how you can argue with something that isn't an argument. People are shit isn't an argument. And yet it's taken as an argument for all of these justifications. So I had to sort of start deconstructing the idea of what it means to be a shithole country or a shithouse country. And even the arguments that it's a shithouse country and we just all misunderstood, because really it's just about infrastructure, because these countries don't have infrastructures. And the amount of highways that you have, that's exactly what was meant by that statement. And I keep thinking, okay, if that is the definition, then yeah, some of us don't have infrastructure, just like some towns in the U.S. don't have infrastructure, because the U.S. is many countries in one, and sometimes not as united as it seems, and sometimes more. So I wondered if our humanity depended on the GDP, then what could I possibly bring to the table to argue with a non-argument? And I thought, and I thought, and then I thought, poetry. Because poetry doesn't require infrastructure. It doesn't require anything. It just flourishes. It's a weed, and it just comes up out of nowhere, and it grows through walls, and it's stubborn, and it's stupid, and it's great. And I thought, maybe. Because I knew a woman once who said one of the most devastating things I've ever heard, and this is a good woman, a kind, generous, religious woman who saw someone with a terrible disability, and with all sincerity, in her heart and in her eyes, she said, "I think that would still be easier than being the parent of a gay child." And it was horrifying. And it was horrifying. And she's a good person and she's a bad person all at once. And now, only like very recently, I heard her say, it is the obligation of the state to give rights to people like that, to make marriage available to everybody. This has just been just a few years, and the only difference is exposure. That's it. She's met people who weren't like her. And no longer does it seem like such an unsurmountable thing. No longer does it seem like such an inhumane thing. And the only thing I have faith in left in this horrible, pitiful world is exposure. So maybe if you saw that we're not that, maybe if you saw that we have poetry and that we grow through the cracks in the walls, maybe it wouldn't be so easy to kill us. Maybe it wouldn't be so easy to put us in cages. Maybe. I don't know. What else do you want to have faith in? So that day, I translated a poem, and I put it on my Facebook, because that's my biggest megaphone. I don't have much else. And the next day, I posted another poem, and the next day another poem, and the next another poem. And in this sort of like wallowing state of utter rage, consuming rage, I started reaching out to people, saying like, okay, so can I have a bigger megaphone? Will anybody give me a bigger podium? And I wrote this like incredibly unprofessional emails to everybody that I could possibly reach out to. And everyone responded very positively, saying, that's really hard, we understand, there's no way that we can give you our site for 100 days. Until I contacted Jen Zobel, who is a wonderful person, a brilliant translator and writer, and she said, when can we start? And then she just gave me the site for 100 days. And it wasn't 100 days, it was about 6 months. Of sleeping an average of 2 hours a night. Because I don't know if you've tried translating a poem a day, finding the poem, because every time that I like hit a wall, like, oh, I'll just translate poems from the 1700s. There are enough of those, right? And then I noticed that they were all from men from a particular social class, and they were all like colonially based, and they were all very religious and a particular thing. Like, I need more women, and more women meant, I don't know if you've read, I purchased 43 anthologies for this project. And women weren't invented until the mid-70s, is what I gather from these anthologies. So I had to then find women poets online, which is hard. It takes about 2 to 3 hours to find someone. And then about half of them will reply, and only a third of those replies will be positive. So I want you to like fit that into a day. And then you have to do the translation. And I roped one of my friends to be my editor, Amanda Dombrink, who is also a fantastic writer. But that's it. That was the staff. It was me, and me, and then me, and then Amanda would edit them very quickly, and then Jen would do a final pass, and they would just go up. So my apartment became consumed, every single wall, I know exactly every copyright law per country. Mexico's a nightmare because they changed the rules midway through. So it's 100 years before 1962, and then it's like 60 years after this, and then there's a gap where like there's an overlap. Haiti is 25 years. I don't know why, but they, yep, that's it. And then I decided that I needed more indigenous writers, and then that was another ordeal. I kept like sleeping less and less. And that's the story of that. How long do we have left? Damn, still more time. Do you have questions for me?
Thank you for that history. You mentioned the first installment of 100 Reputations, which is the manifesto, and sort of acts as the introduction to the project. Mm. And it ends with the voice of the mother saying, "What could you even say to something like that?" And I want to ask you later about your thoughts on the difference between essay and translation, if there is a difference. But can you speak to why, instead of writing perhaps one cohesive essay, you opted for the multidimensional and multi-voiced project of compiling and translating many poems from many poets from many places?
A lot of these choices, like I said, were non-choices. So I was 43 anthologies in. So I honestly don't even know how many poems I read. And I ended up translating close to 130-something, but only 83 of my translations made it in, which then meant that I had to, like, find other translators because I don't translate from French. And I wrote the first essay, and I thought, this will be enough, and I'll never revisit this. But then all these other things kept happening, and I kept having to reframe it. And then I had to group the poems in a way that they would feel cohesive. So there's a music week, so all the poems are about music in one way or another. And I'm an essayist above anything else that I do. I write in three genres, sometimes four, but essays are the things that I come back to. Nonfiction is the thing that interests me the most. The best ones for me about truth, and it's the one inescapable thing that we can't define whatever we do. So it just, after that first week, it just felt like I had to speak to the situation that was there. And the hardest part was, like, I wanted to unplug so often. Like, I just can't do the news anymore. Like, I can't keep this going. And I had to go on Radio Silence for, like, 3 weeks after I finished the project. I just couldn't hear anything else because I felt intoxicated, poisoned by the whole thing. And I also slept for about 3 weeks. So it was a non-choice choice. It all felt like I didn't have choice. Like, what was my choice? Especially at the very beginning, like, no one knew this was happening. Like, after a while, like, it picked up, other people started posting, and it caught on one way or another. But I didn't think anyone was going to read it. I thought it was going to reach maybe 10 people, and I was happy with that. Because otherwise I was just, you know, putting it on Facebook for my mom to not read. So I was happy with that. But then, you know, if you're doing a project where there's no money, there's no glory, there are no contracts, and especially no editors telling you what to do, what not to do, then I had all this freedom that I will never have again. But also I had these obligations that I will maybe not have again either. I set out to make a project out of moral obligation for the people and the places that I love. So I didn't have a choice to have an anthology with only men. That just seemed preposterous. That was not a choice. And I didn't have a choice to not include multiculturalism and different ethnic backgrounds and post-colonial, you know, African writers. And there was no choice in my mind. It just meant the only choice was sleeping less, and that's the choice that I kept making.
I want to go back to the inciting comment that started this whole project, which mm-hmm. is the whole idea of these shit countries or shithole countries. In the task of the translator, Walter Benjamin asks, is a translation meant for readers who do not understand the original? And I want to know how you would answer that question in terms of this project, where someone who's likely to call a country a shithole likely has no intention of learning its language.
Well, it wasn't for the author of the comment.
Right.
Certainly that was not my intended audience. But there's an interesting thing that happens in demonology manuals to summon demons, as we all know. As you all must have demonology manuals at home, surely. I worry that I start things off quite seriously and then people feel very nervous to laugh at obvious things like demonology manuals. But if you know anything about demonology manuals, which you very much should, is that they're full of warnings, and one of the warnings that they have are like, be aware of exorcists, like beware the exorcist. The person who can take something out can also put it in. And it's really, for me, a warning for charismatic leaders and rhetoricians. The person who can teach good can teach bad. The person who can set straight can corrupt. I'm not writing for the exorcists. I'm writing for those who are under the spell and under the power. This complicated losing war and the methods do impact the capacity to win. If it's a moral war, you can't engage in morality in a way, which is a long way of saying this is a losing war, which I completely understand. But sometimes we can only fight fire with marshmallows, and this is the best I've got. And anything short of it, I think, would compromise what I was attempting to do. So I just reached out to the best writers that I could, and I gave them a platform. And it's possible that it meant nothing for the speaker. It definitely meant nothing to the speaker. And it's possible that it meant nothing to those who were impacted and felt this is truth. You know, this is just saying it like it is. But I think it meant a lot to the writers who had never been published in English before. And how is that not good enough?
What you're saying about the people under the spell or the people being impacted is reminding me of something Ishnet Sen writes in The First Circle, which is that the people, as an expression, didn't mean those who speak your language. Neither birth nor the labor of your hands nor the privileges of education admit you to membership of the people. Only your soul can do that. You must strive to temper and to cut and polish your soul so as to become a human being, and hence a humble component of your people. I think that your project seems to be the embodiment of that notion and what it means to be both an individual and a member of the collective, enacted in the form that you choose, which is this collection of translated poems as well as the incorporation of your own personal essays. In your piece, The Empire of Flies, you end with the colonists asking the indigenous people of the Andean Plateau what they were after having referred to the mass of people as flies. The essay ends with their answer, "We," they said, "are people." It is this assertion of humanity, the pride to say as much, and the humility to hone that humanity, as Solzhenitsyn phrases it, that 100 Refutation seems to be working toward. And I'm interested in the incorporation of your own essays into the collected work, which seems to broaden the scope of the people. So how do you see those essays functioning alongside the translated poems?
On a practical level, I just meant them to be as introductions for the week. Like, here's the week. And it gave the Brooklyn Rail team something to put a hashtag to. Like, that was really just a practical aspect of it. They said, oh, get a Twitter account. And not to brag, I did, and I have more than 14 followers. But I hated social media completely. If you give up so much when you write nonfiction, like, there's so much of you that you, like, just present wholly raw, naked, that I just had no interest in, like, having an online presence or, like, presenting. But that was one of the things, like, if I want to do this, then I have to, like, be present. So that was part of it. That was the big part of it. The second part of it is that because I am on the narrative side of things, I love translators. I love translators. I'm not a dedicated translator, so this isn't self-love. But translators, the only time you see a mention of a translator in a review is when to say, oh, really missed the essence of this one word. Like, that's it. When have you ever read a book review and gone, like, also the translator must have done a great job, and going, no. You have one job and then disappear. Like, translators ought to be neither seen nor heard, realistically. And there's also no money in it whatsoever. So, like, why do people translate? Do you know what people translate? Literary translation? Never thought about it? You've never thought about translators at all, have you? You bastards. Listen, translators translate because they love something, and the only objective, the only real reason that you would do something like this is because you want other people to have the chance to love the thing you love. That's it. So I'm not saying that every translator is a noble person, but the vast majority, like, this is the intention, is to, like, bring attention to something that you love. And that was the big perk out of this project, was that I got to pick everything. And I loved everything that I included. And I loved everyone that I included. So I can't remember the question. What was the question? Something about
how you
humanity?
See the essays function.
Oh, yeah. I wanted to draw that attention to, like, the writers. And I felt like it was going so quick. And I was also, like, writing the bios as well, which the bios were, like, so time-consuming. And there were some authors that had never been translated before. And some authors that, like, their existence was questionable. So it was all a big mess. But I felt like the essays could do both. One, I was going out of my mind during this period, and I think you can see the slow decline in my mind, like when you read the essays in order, going like, oh, you're, stop nodding, AJ, stop nodding. But I was stopped sleeping for 6 months. Tell me how that goes for you. So it allowed me to like have an outlet on like, I was just taking all of it in. If I wasn't translating, then I was reading the news and I was staying inside of it. Like, I had to stay angry for 6 months to be able to do this. And the only relief that I got was the poems that I was reading, and a lot of them were quite angry as well. So it allowed me to, like, speak and get some, you know, not to say this, but, like, exercise some of that. And the other one was to, like, present, okay, I love these people, and that couched it in it. So it allowed me to, like, really state my translation purpose very clearly and say a few things about, like, I think I mentioned Assam. I think I have Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz in there as well, who's a phenomenal writer whom everyone should read and know. And I was able to just go, like, I know that this is going to be one poem in 100 and it's going to go by quick, but, like, pay attention to this. This is a big thing that will, if you are at all, if you're reading poetry, you're a very self-selecting group. So here's one that you need to be paying attention to. Ideally all of them, but she's quintessential. Yeah.
I think so often we look at the binaries between the genres, and I like that this is a compilation of at least two genres. But translation, according to Benjamin again, is a form.
Translation
is a form, right?
To Benjamin, you're
putting it. It's not its own genre, though, because it's dependent on the original. If you're so, mm-hmm. That's not my opinion. That's
no. You can hide behind Benjamin. That's fine.
But I want to know what you think is the essential difference between the work of the essay and the work of translation. Because if we always go back to the etymology of an essay, which is the verb essay to try, mm-hmm. or an attempt. And so you said something about translators translate because they love something and they want to give, you know, attention to it. So is that different from the task of the essayist?
Yes. In that sense, they are quite different. But my own work, so I got a literary translation and MFA more or less the same time. I did the bulk of the work for both of them in 3 years. Then I had a year to find a job, which I failed to do, and it ended up moving to China. It's fine. Again, I'm totally fine. But I did them simultaneously, which means that I was like thinking about them in the same way. And to me, they are, for me, translation, literary translation is a genre for one particular reason. Is that you have to be a writer to translate literature. You have to be a writer and you have to have a different mindset. Just like you, if you are a poet, you have a mindset. Like, I can't think in like the breaking of the lines. I can't do that. I write in essays. I think in essay form and in narrative more specifically. So when I did my work, my thesis was also blended, and the thesis became Don't Come Back, that book. And my book is full of diagrams of me translating aphorisms because they're the hardest things that I could think to write, and that's the way that my brain works. Like, what's the hardest thing that I could possibly do? Don't sleep for 6 months and do this project? Yes, let's do that. Surely it won't kill us. Nearly did. I'm fine. I get. But the translation of a thing, like, that's, I think this is, it messes with like the idea, we feel very comfortable where the original is truth, and then you have a reiteration of it, like that's a facsimile, that's a copy, and all translation is inferior, when in reality translation is interpretation, right? So when you, I read the original Gabriel Garcia Marquez, I read Cortázar, and I read Borges in Spanish, but then I'll also read them in English. Oftentimes, and I'll read even like Borges's translations of Borges, is Borges interpreting Borges, and he changes words. Words like they gather crumbs in the Gospel according to Mark. They steal crumbs. He translated it to steal. He just rewrote it, right? Like, which is fine because it's Borges, but no one anthologizes Borges's translation of Borges because he changed that word, right? Like, but what is truth? So I think translation gives you all this like beautiful capacity to like see a work in 360 degrees, not to just rely on your own interpretation, but to see the textual different interpretation instead of just getting footnotes, which isn't the story itself. So translation is very much a form of nonfiction in my mind, because the same happens with your experiences. When you sit down to write your experiences, really you're not writing the experience itself, you're writing some interpretation of it. And usually the interpretation that makes you look the best, which isn't all interpretations. It isn't even the best interpretation. It's the interpretation that allows you to sleep well at night. That's what most people do. I think the best nonfiction writers really commit to not sleeping in that sense either. What is the interpretation that will like lead me to attempt to think more thoroughly, to abandon a confirmation bias for myself? And the best translation does that as well, where you love a thing for what it does, and then you forget yourself, and you try to push it forward. So for me, translation and nonfiction are versions of each other. They're perfect metaphors and analogs to talk about one another. And in my own work, it's impossible for me to not deal with it, because a lot of the things that I write happen in Spanish. Every line that you've ever read, like that said, like, what can you do? Lena, calm down. My mother didn't say that. She doesn't speak to me in English. She never has. She only says one thing in English because it's uncomfortable for her to say in Spanish, and that's, I love you. That's it. So how can you look at that and go like, well, this is true, but stealing crumbs isn't, right? This is just, you know, approximations. We're always communicating in approximations. And I think that that's the reason that I come back to nonfiction, the reason I like to teach translation, is when we acknowledge that we are all wrong, then that's the only place where I think good decisions can come from. I think the man with his hand on the trigger has no doubt. The man with the bomb vest has no doubt. We often have no doubt. And uncertainty is one of the last lines of defense for inhumanity.
That's a lot. I think I'm paraphrasing because I'm just going off memory, but in that piece, The Task of the Translator, he refers to translation as being outside of the forest and as a sort of echoing of the original, but it's not mimicry. It's this sort of like needing the reverberation to be a different iteration that'll be understood by a different populace. And so I think that's sort of speaking to what you've been speaking about, which is interesting. I want to ask, just in terms of Blackbird, so often when we set content, we have sort of happy accidents, things that we maybe consciously or unconsciously accepted that speak to one another really well, pieces that seem really cohesive. I'm wondering if there were any sort of surprises when you were compiling those pieces, when you looked at it at the end, when they were all together.
I mean, I did the reason that it took 6 months, I think it's February 11th, maybe, the moment that comment was uttered, and I worked nonstop until July 28th or something like that, which is a long time to be doing that. So, can't remember where I was going with this. What was your question?
How they sort of speak.
Oh, right. So the reason for this, that it took that long is because I asked Jen Zobel, the editor of In Translation, to give me time to start, like, I wanted things to fit together, because even in the rush of things, which you just have to let some things go. This is one of the most important things as a writer, is like, learn to let things go. Like, this is the deadline. You just work as fast as you can and as hard as you can until you reach it. But even that, like, I was still really wanting to be very much in control. So I, all weeks fit together. Like, they all have a theme. So I wrote an essay where I talked about Celia Cruz, whom I will forever love. She is a patron saint of Latin American music and Latin America in general. And the entire week was music. And then I think the interrogation of Assam was about slavery. So like if it seems like there are all these happy accidents, it's actually just me sleeplessly. Like, I had a whole wall covered in post-it notes, and I just kept moving the essays, the poems back and forth to fit, and then once I had that week, then I would write the essay. But the essay, I think you wanted me to talk about the pineapple essay.
Oh, yeah.
I wrote that essay during Mission Creek, which is a music and literature festival in Iowa City, and I had to go do a reading, and I was just there that week, and I wrote that essay in the library an hour before I had to go do a reading on a scrap of paper. And a napkin, because those were the only pages that I had, and I just like wrote it as quickly as I possibly could. And then that night, like, I got home to my friend's house and I just typed it up and I sent, like, there was, that's it, like, that was all the time that I had. So I did my best to organize things as much as possible, but I still had a day job. Like, I was still teaching and I was still like doing all the readings and all the things that I had to do. So the only happy accident is that it all got published, that it all made it through. and I just try not to look at it because I know that it'll drive me crazy when I do.
So nothing surprised you?
Nothing surprised me of, like, all the hard work that I put in tracking things down. Is that what you're asking me? I don't know what you're asking me. Like, the poems didn't exist. Like, they were, like, a red 43 anthologies.
Content-wise, I mean, having them all laid out together, there was nothing that hadn't anticipated.
So I did, it was such a rush. I tried to do as much as I could before I got there, but even when I got there, like, I was, even on the last week, I was pulling things out. Like, I was still reaching out, like, waiting for a poet to write me back, and all of these things happened where, like, poets started pulling out when they started feeling vulnerable, or somebody was processing their visa, somebody, the U.S. was processing their visa, and they justifiably felt like, this is gonna hurt me, like, I can't. So they pulled things out, and I had to, like, reorganize everything. So the surprise were when things really worked. But I also had more poems than I ended up including. So I think I translated something like 132, 134, something like that. So there, if you are in a period of time, slavery is gonna get talked about a lot. Yeah, I think the surprising thing is that so many people said yes quickly, immediately in an email, and just trusted me with their work. I think that was the most surprising thing.
So my final question. Mm-hmm. In the manifesto, there's that really visceral sense of rage and injustice upon hearing the comment. And then the works that follow operate on a spectrum of emotion. It's not just this one point of rage. And then in the coda, there's this repeated phrase, faith and effort, which really seems to speak toward the project as a whole. Faith and effort both bear a great sense of gravity and themselves can arise from rage or from contentment and have the capacity to bring a person to either place. How has your understanding been changed by this project, or how have you been changed by this project? And was there a sense of revelation?
I wanted it to crack open at some point. It is a lonely thing. And I, because we were rushing through it so quickly, I never knew how many people were looking at the poems. Like, Brooker and Rail had all those stats. But I literally had no time to ask. Like, I didn't have time to, like, write the email to say, Jen, do you know the stats of, like, how many people are seeing this? And I don't think I'm not lying, there isn't any facade to how I'm presenting the birth of the project. Like, it was just, I was angry and I didn't know where else to turn or where to yell. So this was just me yelling a lot, hoping that I would keep my voice long enough to keep yelling for 100 days, for 6 months. But it's a very lonely thing. I often find places to volunteer, and I like volunteering because there's an immediate thing. Like, you know, at the very least, this person has a coat. This person had a meal today. This person did this. I helped this person, like, put a job, like, a resume together, or find a job, or, like, they're looking at a house. Like, that's immediate, and that's real, and that's raw, and, like, the essence of evil is the suffering of another human being. Like, that's just, it's simple, and it's clear, and it's direct. And we can talk about moral philosophy and abstraction all we want, but that's concrete. This wasn't concrete, and I never saw anything or anyone. So I think that part of the big exhaustion is that I was seeing cages, like, I was seeing that suffering, like, that was really present and clear and concrete and inescapable, but all of my raging was very abstract and invisible, and I never, like, I think that there were, like, secret fantasies of being able to see something from it. That never happened. And that's just really, really exhausting, because that's the most real thing in the world. And I'm often, because I have more time to work in my essays, because I write about this. This isn't a departure. It's only a departure in that it's a, like, I'd never translated that much poetry in my life so intensely and consecutively. But everything else that I do is always about this violence, and always about, we have this, I think, very stupid notion that violence and brutality is something pertaining to the animal part of ourselves. But animals don't commit genocide. Like, this animalistic aspect of it is our own personal scapegoat. Civilization and violence go together. This is our thing. This is our invention, and this is the thing that we continually feed, and then feed ourselves a lie that if only we were more civilized, if only that were true.
There's nothing more civilized than the Crusades. There is nothing more meticulous than the Holocaust. This is an absurdity. And the moment that we let go of that and we accept it, I think that we might be able to deal with ourselves better and each other. So that's, I think, the essence of most of my work, the belief and exposure to the humanity of others and the brutality of ourselves. If I could have anything, if I could wish for anything that somebody like picks up something that I write and then walks away with it, I would hope that you are a little bit more afraid of yourself than you were before. That's my goal. So I was a little bit more afraid of myself at the end of this. That wasn't what I was hoping for. And I was afraid because I had allowed myself to believe in that this would be something tangible, that I could feel good about myself at the end of it. And that's not how this works. We are also, like, we get stuck in these notions of, I will offer to, like, give up my coat, and then the fairy will come up and go, like, because you've given up your coat, you can have this palace of gold. That's not how sacrifice works. Sacrifice is actual, and it's real. You give a thing up, and you don't get it back. And one of the things that I gave up was missing an awful lot of deadlines. I would have finished a book by now, another book by now, and I didn't because I chose to do this, a thing that very few people have seen. How do I feel about that? That's actual sacrifice. Sacrifice is a thing that I get no glory for. Not sacrifice is a thing that you do because you think you'll give it up, but secretly somebody's going to recognize it and go, like, here's $1 million, write us more books. Like, I recognize how good a person you are. I give up a thing, and that thing is gone, and that time is gone, and it's not the thing that I wanted, but it is the person I want to be. So I'd much rather be someone in a moment rather than have the moments that I long for. If that makes sense.
It does. Thank you so much for answering all those questions. Maybe we have time for a couple questions.
I wanted to ask, I have seen a few translations, but I would like to ask, how can you balance out the original message with the interpretation? Especially when so many things are cultural references or historical references that get lost in between.
I think you don't. I think that's what you do. I love the idea of the question that you get most often when you say I'm a translator is like, okay, so tell me what's the good translation. Like, let me, like, go through and then go. I'm like, and very few times do I go, like, don't read this translation. I'm like, okay, so this is a good translation to start with, right? Like, why not have, like, a thousand flowers bloom and, like, have all these different translations interpreted? I can't give you anything but my own interpretation. And I can tell you that because I'm an essayist, I have a very particular way of translating certain things. And I also have a particular taste. And I love surrealist poetry. So you're going to find a lot of, like, strange surrealist poetry going, like, how does this speak to this thing? There was an Animal Week. That was my favorite one. And my favorite, I have a lot of all of them are my favorite. I picked them. They're my children. But my favorite title was The Existential Nothingness of Crabs. I'm like, whatever that is. I contacted the author, the poet, before I read the poem. I'm like, I read the title. I'm like, I want it. That's it. Like, that's all I want. Was it 4 a.m? Sure. Yes. Was it a good, right choice? Yes, it was. I stand by it. She's fantastic. So that is like a shortcut, is to ask the translator. And I think that there was one line that I could have translated as a banner or a she Christ. And I was able to, like, contact her going, like, so do you mean banner or she Christ? And surrealist poetry is the hardest thing to translate because they put things together like, I am a banner or I am a she Christ. And, like, that makes as much sense in this sentence as anything else. So translating live poets is great because they'll tell you, but it's terrible because they'll tell you. So I think you just kind of have to decide, I am the person translating this now, no one else was translating it, and I love the idea that somebody would read my translation and go, like, she got it wrong, let me retranslate it for you. Great. Now there are two things online that you can search, a poet that no one had translated before, and you can go, yeah, these two are better, or Lena is terrible, but this one is great, and no one knew about it before I could put it on top. So I know that there's quite a few that had never been translated before, so that wasn't your question, but the answer is, I don't think you can. I don't think you can really fully divorce yourself of your own biases, but you can invite other people to join the conversation.
Thank you.
So I definitely want to know if it was Banner or She Christ?
It was She Christ.
Okay.
I am a She Christ. Soy una Crista.
And then going off of that, I want to know, in the process of translation, you have to acknowledge that perhaps, maybe not in that instance, but perhaps the poet or the writer was using a word that had more than one meaning on purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you deal with that in translation if it doesn't translate neatly to another word that has both of those?
Well, this was the one thing that I gave up. The one thing that I gave up was nothing rhymes. Like, I just gave up rhyme. Like, that was the one thing that I could, like, compromise and go, I'm okay with this, and this is the only way that I'm going to be able to do this. Translating the last poem I translated before 100 Reputations took me 3 weeks to translate, and it's about this long, and I had help. Like, how much, like, obsessive going, like, okay, so is this, there was, it's called La Perrilla by this famous José Manuel Marroquín. He's this Colombian poet, and also he became the president. It was complicated, but he wrote this absurdist poetry about this squalid dog and this big boar, and the big boar was like just tearing, like, what is it, causing havoc? That's how you say it in English?
Wreaking
havoc. And the knights came, and then the archers came, and everyone came, and the like full armor trying to take down this boar, and then lo comes this squalid dog that no one knows, like no one has noticed before, and it's like this like wild wild west wah 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 type like notion. And then she like faces up against the boar, and the poem ends with, and she too could not take him. Like, why? Why? And it took me 3 weeks to translate this, and the big conversation, I had hours of conversation with my writing partner Sarah Vereen, going like, do we translate it as the little bitch? Because perrilla is she dog, like little bitch, or the wee she dog, or the wee dog feminine, or do we put brackets around it? So, like, that is 3 days of conversations and debating. I threw that out the window, and I kept that. Like, I thought that was a better conversation for me to have with myself than to do the rhyme. So I threw out the rhyme, and a lot of like the 1700 poetry was dependent on the rhyme. And once you took that out, it was a lot easier to like do the interpretation. And when it was really, really hard, I kept both things in. I'm like, I'm going to add a line, and then those two lines are going to play off of each other, and that'll give the enough sense of equivocation for somebody to like understand some aspect of the poem. I think some aspect of the poem is the only thing that you can aim to translate. That's just it. If you don't believe me, go read Le Tombeau de Marot, which is a 500-page translator's joke, where I think... Hofstetter translates one poem like 60, 70 times, just over and over again. It's about this long. Anyway, it's really good. If you like translation jokes, I don't know. I don't know you. I've never met you before. I'm doing my best.
I know you have to go.
I do.
Thank you, Lena, for coming.